Welcome to Changelog and Friends, a weekly talk show about the Vibe Coding Gold Rush. Thanks, as always, to our partners at Fly.io, the public cloud built for developers who ship. If you ship like we do, you should ship where we do at Fly.io. Okay, let's talk.
Well, friends, I'm here with a good old friend of mine, Terrence Lee, cloud native architect at Heroku. So Terrence, the next gen of Heroku called Fur is coming soon. What can you say about the next generation for Heroku?
Fur represents the next decade of Heroku. You know, Cedar lasted for 14 years and more, still going. And Heroku has this history of using trees to represent ushering in new technology stacks and foundations for the platform. And so like Cedar before, which we've had for over a decade, we're thinking about Fur in the same way. So if you're familiar with fir trees at all, Douglas firs, they're known for their stability and resilience. And that's what you want for the foundation of a platform that you're going to trust your business on top of. We've used stacks to kind of usher in this new technology. And what that means for Fur is we're replatforming on top of open standards. A lot has changed over the last decade. Things like container images and OCI and Kubernetes and CloudNative, all these things have happened in this space. And instead of being on our own island, we're embracing those technologies and standards that we help popularize and pulling them into our technology stack. And so that means you as a customer don't have to kind of pick or choose. So as an example, on Cedar today, we produce a proprietary tarball called Slugs. That's how you run your apps. That's how we package them. On Fur, we're just going to use OCI images, right? So that means that tools like Docker are part of this ecosystem that you get to use. So with our cloud native build packs, you can build your app locally with a tool called Pack and then run it inside Docker. And that's the same kind of basic technology stack we're going to be running in Fur. So you can run them in your platform as well. So we're providing this access to tools and things that people, developers are already using and extensibility on the platform that you haven't had before. But this, you know, sounds like a lot of change, right? And so what isn't changing? And what isn't changing is the Heroku you know and love. That's about focusing on apps and on infrastructure and focusing on developer productivity. And so you're still going to have that Git push Heroku main experience. You're still going to be able to connect your applications and pipelines up to GitHub, have that Heroku flow. We're still about abstracting out the infrastructure from underneath you and allowing you as an app developer to focus on developer productivity.
Well, the next generation of Heroku is coming soon. I hope you're excited because I know a lot of us, me included, have a massive love and place in our heart for Heroku. And this next generation of Heroku sounds very promising. To learn more, go to Heroku.com/changelogpodcast and get excited about what's to come for Heroku. Once again, Heroku.com/changelogpodcast.
Well, my old friend, Amel Hussein, who you probably heard and saw on our recent friendly feud, but you're probably wondering, where'd she go? She's here with me for a one-on-one. Amel, welcome to the Changelog.
Hello, Jared. I'm so excited to be back. It's been a real like whirlwind, exciting year for me. Yeah. And, you know, I haven't done barely any podcasting. It's like, life has been kind of turned up to the max on all levels, which right. I think we'll unpack shortly.
Absolutely.
But so happy to be back and yeah, share what I've been up to and all the new things that are happening in my life. And yeah, I think we're gonna you know, dig into all the things. So
yeah, absolutely. So we're recording on a Thursday morning, which is not our regular time. I'm drinking coffee, so forgive me if I'm not as sharp as you're used to when we chit-chat around lunchtime or noon or 2 p.m. usually. See, I already misspoke because I haven't had enough caffeine yet, but we're recording early on Thursday morning because you've been working this week and you've been having a huge feature you're trying to ship. We want to get into your journey. I don't even understand your journey as somebody who knows you pretty well because like you were at NPM and then this happened and was it Stripe or Meta or this and that, some other company for a while, and now I'm not, I don't even know where you work yet.
Yeah, I know. I don't even know where I work either. I don't either.
So you've been making moves, but recently, literally this week, we had to bump recording a few times just because trying to get a big feature out And did you ship it? I assumed you shipped it because here you are.
We shipped it. I signed off 9 p.m. Eastern last night. I live on the East Coast. It's a long, long day, but no, we had a pretty big release going out this month. Data migrations and just a huge, huge release that also my team was in charge of, kind of adding in an authentication layer to our integrations platform, which is, you know, what I'm in charge of. We'll dig into that. And so we're kind of, adding in support for doing, integrations that require third-party auth. And so that really touched everything and, literally every part. And so, it's always like release days are always, there's always getting through the release pipeline. Those challenges are very real.
Right. And you thought it was going to be released earlier than that. In fact, correct. That's why we bumped a couple times, which is totally cool with me, but yeah. I just think it's funny when it's like, yeah, it should be done Tuesday morning, and it's like, well, maybe Wednesday morning. It's like, well, how about 9 p.m. Eastern?
Yeah.
So did something go wrong or?
It's not so much that stuff went wrong. Well, a couple things, like, migrations are always tricky, right? There's that. Definitely some things got adjusted. It was more actually, I think what we were really bitten by was, the developer definition of done, right? I think we always forget to account for done is not just when I'm done. It's also not, it's when code's been reviewed and code review updates have gone through and CI has kind of done its thing and we've fixed any new problems from the changes and we've deployed somewhere off your machine and we've integrated, it's like there's this, literally almost 30% of the work starts when a developer thinks that they're done.
They're done. Yeah.
And
it's kind of a romantic optimism, it's pretty much finished, right? I'm done. And like you said, there's still the other 80% to go.
And I tell this to my team. So we were kind of in this interesting mode where, we're working on this massive new integration, massive, thing that just touches everything front to back, right to left. So then we're in the 20% phase of this project where you've done 80% of the work and you have 20% left. Mm-hmm. So then there's, then you're struck by the fact that 80% of the work is in the last 20 and then you're done with what you think is done, but then you have to still get it over the wire, which is then a new clock starts, right? And then you're in another 80-20. And so, I think just, shipping to production, shipping massive changes, specifically things that go horizontal across, multiple parts of your application, multiple parts, multiple projects in our, in our case. It's no small feat. I miss the days when, I was working purely on front end or something along those lines, right? Where I feel like, the front end community has the most enviable release process in many ways. It's just the fastest and then, but it's, that's because the benefit of just being on the top of the stack. Right. Anything lower is and that's been a big shift for me. I've worked on full stack applications pretty much most of my career. I've spent a lot of time in the middle front, started out in the back, kind of moved up over time. And then kind of spent a good chunk of my time, in middleware layers, in the middle of the app. And now I'm managing a pretty complex platform team. And, I was actually a principal engineer, still kind of am doing I'm doing that crazy job that's TLM, tech lead manager, a principal engineer with direct reports. Now they're like, oh, Mel, you're basically just running this whole thing. Here, you just take this org, you run this now.
There you go.
So that kind of happens to me, and just why I've been pendulum swinging throughout my career. I've been doing this yo-yo between, principal and manager and lead engineer and manager. And so, I enjoy doing both jobs. Definitely doing more principal right now because I have a team of very senior engineers and I don't really need to do much management per se. It's more just like giving my team technical direction and like setting our, you know, here's the architecture, here's the plan, here's what we're doing. Like, mm-hmm. you know.
So give me your, like, enumerate to me the companies that you've worked for, because when we first met, this was probably 2018, 2017, something like this. You were at Boku, I believe. We met at All Things Open one of those years. And so for our listeners' sake, we've known each other for that long. And then we met there, hit it off, had a great time. We invited you on the changelog. I think we had a great changelog conversation back then. So good, I think, that we even put a quote of yours in our trailer, because it was just so high quality what you're talking about, like real applications are they're gnarly and they got these, you know, problems. And it was just like a really
they're
good
living, breathing.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was like, I invited you on JS Party. Back then you had the web platform podcast, but it was kind of on, not a hiatus, but just you guys were struggling to ship. And I was like, why don't you just come be a panelist? And so you were a panelist on JS Party for many years. And during that time, it was like Boku, and then it was NPM. Am I right? Mm-hmm. And then NPM got acquired, or were you already?
NPM got acquired. And then shortly after, they, you know, laid off majority of the company.
Right.
It sounds like three people. So it was, so I was part of that. And
then what happened?
It was like this horrible thing where like they, only three people got offers to transition into GitHub. It when one of them was the founder, the other one was the community face. So they couldn't, you know, obviously like that would be bad. And then the other one would be, the other person was the, just the lead, the architect that was still there, the single person that had the continuity of the legacy code base. And then other folks were, put on short-term contracts just to finish up and or laid off. It was rough. So after that, I ended up at a pretty, at the time, a pretty cool unicorn startup called Indigo, which is like an ag tech company.
Okay, I do remember this. Yes.
Yeah, I was like building Uber for ag. I was basically a principal engineer building like Uber for agriculture. It was actually a pretty rewarding time in my career because, got to learn a lot about the challenges in the ag world and digitizing it and, kind of bringing it into like the 21st century. The company, had everything going for it, like again, very high valuation, like attracted a lot of really top talent, et cetera. And, just unfortunately just kind of fell into that same pit, I think, with startups sometimes when they're doing too well, but then they get struck by bad product management and like leadership decisions and just, I don't know what's going on now, but like still exists and is still doing its thing. But like, I am no longer there. Neither is many of the people that I worked with. A lot of people have exited, had a lot of layoffs. And then I ended up at Stripe after that. Stripe was pretty fun. I was a staff engineer, but it was just also the hustle culture and the stress of that job was just not really worth it for me. It's like absolutely zero work-life balance. And at that point, I'm just at a point in my career where like, I want to work hard. I do work hard naturally. Right. So you have person like me, who's like a hard worker, and then you add in the like, oh my God, people can fake collaborating, but competing, kind of culture, which, I hate to say this as well. I don't really talk about this publicly, but I definitely also experienced like a fair level of toxicity from coworkers, in that role. And so it was just, it was just like, okay, not worth it. I had multiple offers when I joined Stripe, right? Like literally. So
you picked Stripe, these were the good days, right? When like you could just line up offers and you were lining them up and good for you. So Stripe was obviously an attractive, especially from the outside. It's an attractive place to work. I'm sure the compensation was great. The tech problems are interesting.
Very much.
But the hustle culture is certainly still there.
Yeah.
So then you left Stripe and then what?
So then, I had lots of offers and I was like, okay, well, I need to optimize for, just being at Stripe. I was like, oh my God, this is like, Stripe had a little bit of a Peter Pan syndrome. And I can't take credit for that. I won't name the person who came up with that, but it was so accurate. Peter Pan being like, doesn't really want to grow up. Like it was this massive company that still tried to act small. And that caused a lot of problems, and so,
that's interesting because GitHub was like that for a while, where they, they had this like engineering, not just engineering led, but like engineers do what they want culture. And it was really cool and attracted great engineers at the start. And I remember Zach Holman, who's an early GitHuber, who was like on the conference scene going around talking about like this new style of company, which is like engineering led, and you work on what you want to. And it's all like the stuff that we want to hear, you know? And that didn't scale. I mean, it's no surprise, but it was like, as GitHub grew, that just wasn't going to work anymore. And GitHub, to their credit, and Chris Wanstroth and Tom Preston Warner and the other leaders inside GitHub that started it, they actually did grow up. I mean, they decided to make changes, and some of those changes were hard and some were better than others and mishandled. And of course, there were all kinds of issues along the way, but GitHub did grow up, and then it grew up so much that now it's like, you know, Microsoft bought it, and now it's like as grown up as you could possibly be, I think probably to its dismay at this point. But they had that to start, but then they actually, I think, realized it. They're like, this is not going to last. And maybe it's interesting that at least when you were at Stripe, that culture had still existed there. And I'm wondering if it's holding them back.
Yeah, I think your hypothesis is and your question comment at the end was like very on point. I do think it is holding them back in many ways. And, you know, like, yeah, we haven't seen an IPO for many reasons. Like, you know, when I was there, it was like IPO in 2 months,
I'm pretty sure there's lots of people that would love to see that IPO happen.
Oh, my God. It was expected to be the biggest. I mean, you know, when I joined Stripe, it was the most valuable VC backed company in the world. Like, I think it was like almost $100 billion valuation or something mad, like wild like that. Just there's so many great things about the product, the company, the ethos, you know, I think. But yeah, definitely like needs a heavy dose of grown up on many levels. And I'll just kind of like leave it at that.
Sure. So where'd you head after Stripe then?
So after Stripe, I was like optimizing for the opposite of Stripe, you know, like I said, like I was in a very fortunate position. And I was like, okay, like I really just kind of want to be back in enterprise. I really thrive in enterprise. I spent a decent amount of my time in enterprise. And so I was like, all right, like, you know, was being poached by a team at Cisco working on a really important product that's like a single pane of like bringing Cisco together. Like Cisco is a massive company, sixth largest software company in the world. And so they're bringing together, you know,
kind of quietly too, you know, you don't think about it too much probably because they're at the network layer most of the time.
Yeah. Network layer, but everything runs through Cisco software and hardware.
100%. Yeah, totally. That's what I said. It's kind of like Intel inside, you know, it's like Cisco outside, but you don't think about it very much as like such a big player, but it certainly is.
Right. And the company overall is just like a really nice company, really well run. Like it was actually really refreshing to be there because they've got like a really good internal, like their internal, you know, it's basically like you're exposed to like, wow, this is how big businesses run well on the inside, right? Where you literally have like 30% or something like that of the staff is dedicated towards internal operations, you know, whether it's HR or like anything, like, right, like you're just, you have people in roles that are facing inward on the business itself, operating on the business. And so I think that was just very refreshing, I think, after being at like a Peter Pan company, you know, and but also like, I think the flip side to that with Cisco is unfortunately like, you know, one of the challenges we're dealing with in an org that's trying to kind of innovate and push things forward. We're kind of like a spear, you know, we were like the COO's kind of pet project, you know, like kind of an innovation component is that you're battling against a lot of just like legacy culture around bureaucracy and what I like to call like castle wall guarding. What am I thinking of? Like people kind of protecting their forts,
gatekeeping.
You know, not gatekeeping, just like people either they're trying to protect, like grow their orgs, grow their reporting
chains.
They're
on guard. They are guarding.
Castle guarding or whatever, okay. Right? Like,
yeah,
you know, and you just deal with a lot of bureaucracy and politics. And so I think that was the biggest turnoff for me was like, man, like, you know, and someone like me, that's a little bit of a, you know, I hate to use the word, but it's corny and way overused, but a little bit of a disruptor in the sense that like, you know, I kind of act as a catalyst at, you know, in many places that I join and just kind of trying to move things forward and quickly, you know?
Right. Let me say it for you, cause you don't want to say it yourself, but like any room that you come into, like the room changes, you know, like you're going to have an impact. It's just true. Like your that's you're that right. You're that kind of a presence where it's like, oh, Amel's here, you know, and we all know it and we're happy. Some people are probably not happy, especially if they're trying to guard that room.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, you're definitely a disruptor. I think it is an overused word, but it's certainly fair because you're going to make an impact, and that's powerful.
Yeah. Well, your words, and thank you. It's very kind feedback. But you know, so it basically that was just an interesting challenge. I was like, you know, just getting things done, like ruffled feathers, and you know, yeah. I was just really like very proud of the impact that I made there and the amount of time and the change that I was able to kind of bring to my team and the work that we were doing. But just kind of like politics was the kind of downside there. Otherwise, just amazing people, really just impressively run business. And, you know, I think the challenge there is just like, yeah, they're going to need to change some of their internal cultures, I think, in order to really compete moving forward, right? Because you just can't, like, that level of politicking and bureaucracy just cannot exist if you want to kind of compete in 2025. And what's interesting, you know, when they want to move fast, they move fast, but then there's also just a lot of, yeah, back channeling that, you know, happens. So, yeah. But so Cisco had, so basically our org was, you know, unfortunately, like the COO, the person who of the company who kind of was like, you know, shepherding this project, you know, she exited the company. So that, you know, you have your executive sponsors kind of gone, and she was on, you know, and so it was just, you know, we had new leadership come in from Google, they started chopping things, you know, and so just, it was kind of a little bit of a bloodbath. And I got caught up in a wave of restructuring which I was very fortunate because there's other people who were just straight up just laid off. And so the restructuring for me was like, okay, you have a job. We want you to stay at Cisco. Here's 3 months to do nothing other than just go find internal jobs that are open or externally. You can do whatever you want. But in 3 months, if you choose to either not pick a team internally and or leave, like you're going to get a severance. So I just was like, you know what? Like I think I'm good, actually. I'm just going to ride out these three months.
That happened to Justin Garrison at AWS. He had the exact same thing. I think he ended up terming it silent sacking because it's like they don't want to actually let you go, but they're going to put you in like a, not necessarily a lose-lose, but like a very hard to win game where it's like you need to find something else to do. And with him, I think they're just going to keep paying him because they kind of slipped under the radar and they're just going to keep on paying him. And he's like, I'm not going to stick around for this because who knows? But that was a move that I think, you know, corporates were making at that time. Right. Some of it was to either decrease the size of their layoffs, make it not look so bad. So it's like a silent sacking where they're like, find something to do. And well, what if I don't want to do any of those things or I can't or, you know, whatever it was.
Right.
They also had that RTO policy, which I think he was going to be suffering under. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's the other. It's like let's do layoffs without having to pay out severance packages, like strategy, you know. But yeah, it's so. I mean, I for me it was just, you know, it wasn't just me, right? It was like, you know, many people, and we the folks that were in my round, you know, we're really just kind of like high cost numbers in a spreadsheet, like, you know, like I was in the middle of like delivering some very important work and making some incredible progress. And, you know, whether it was my performance reviews or just reviews, you know, peer feedback and all of that stuff, Cisco had this nice thing where like people give each other money, you know, they like for, you know, thank you for this thing. Here's like $25 to go spend on some like website to like, you know, so like, I literally had like thousands of dollars racked up from like thank yous and praise. And so, you know, I had all indicators were, you know, high performer, obviously.
Right. Like you're doing a good job.
Yeah. There. And it was just cost driven, you know, it was like, we're this, and I would agree with like the fact that like, yeah, the overall org was pretty bloated. You know, they kind of hired aggressively. And again, I think part of that was driven by this culture of, again, castle building, you know, castle guarding, like, oh, I'm going to make my reporting chain the biggest. I'm going to hire people I don't need so that I have like authority and, you know. And totally. So, yeah, it's just the one downside, you know, but, yeah, if Cisco, like, you know, would I,
would I work there in the future if that problem didn't exist and if I were guaranteed to like,
right.
you know, probably, yeah, you know. But hopefully I don't want to though, because I now am so happy at work. I just want to like retire with this company. I don't want to do anything else, you know.
Well, friends, I'm here with a brand new friend of mine, Kyle Galbraith, co-founder and CEO of Depot.dev. Your builds don't have to be slow. You know that, right? Build faster, waste less time, accelerate Docker image builds, GitHub Action builds, and so much more. So, Kyle, we're in the hallway at our favorite tech conference, and we're talking. How do you describe Depot to me?
Depot is a build acceleration platform. The reason we went and built it is because we got so fed up and annoyed with slow builds for Docker image builds, GitHub Action runners. And so we're relentlessly focused on accelerating builds. Today, we can make a container image build up to 40 times faster. We can make a GitHub Action runner up to 10 times faster. We just rolled out Depot Cache. We essentially bring all of the cache architecture that backs both GitHub Actions and our container image build product, and we open it up to other build tools like Bazel and Turbo Repo, SCCache, Gradle, things like that. So now we're starting to accelerate more generic types of builds and make those 3 to 5 times faster as well. And so in simple terms, the way you can think about Depot is it's a build acceleration platform to save you hundreds of hours of build time per week, no matter whether that's build time that happens locally, that's build time that happens in a CI environment. We fundamentally believe that the future we want to build is a future where builds are effectively near instant, no matter what the build is. We want to get there by effectively rethinking what a build is and turn this paradigm on its head and say, hey, a build can actually be fast and consistently fast all the time if we build out the compute and the services around that build to actually make it fast and prioritize performance as a top-level entity rather than an afterthought.
Yes. Okay, friends. Save your time, get faster builds with Depot, Docker builds, faster GitHub Action runners, and distributed remote caching for Bazel, Go, Gradle, Turbo Repo, and more. Depot is on a mission to give you back your dev time and help you get faster build times with a one-line code change. Learn more at depot.dev. Get started with a 7-day free trial. No credit card required. Again, depot.dev.
So where are you working now? So this is your new thing. This
yeah.
is your
yeah.
Is it startup? Is that what it is?
It is. I am
okay. Back
in,
to the startup yeah. side of things.
Yeah, I feel like singing that song. I'm back in the saddle again. You know?
Yeah,
I really am. I've never been at a startup this early stage, but also like high competence. And
how early, like Series A or pre?
Yeah, we just closed Series A, but we were like we closed it late because, again, like the company, we have revenue coming in. There's no like desperate need to raise, if that makes sense. And so yeah, so company's a few years old, but yeah, we're Series A now. I'm like, do I want? I have not publicly announced this at all.
Like, let's break some news here. I mean, it's not even on your LinkedIn or what?
It's like, not anything. I'm like, oh yeah, no. Like, I do not. My 2025 goal is to use LinkedIn. Like, as in, I have a LinkedIn profile. I do not use it because every time I log on, it's like feels like it's like corporate worship meets corporate Facebook.
I think it's to its credit, and I've been a LinkedIn hater for many years. Adam loves LinkedIn, and he has because he's gotten a lot of value out of it. I never got any value out of it for a long time, but it's becoming now one of the only places where everybody is because mm-hmm. and they're like, I don't want to say like they behave themselves, but it's like it's nice. People are nicer there because yeah. you know it's your. This is your professional network.
Persona, right?
That being said, it's starting to loosen up a little bit. Their feed is terrible the way they load it. Mm-hmm. Like I'm never enjoying the content there, mm-hmm. but people are starting to post some memes. Like I can feel like I can be there myself there a little bit. I've started to like post random stuff and it gets good reactions. And so I don't know.
That's how it starts. Like
exactly.
before you know it, it's going to be like a cesspool. It's just slippery
yeah,
slope.
But it's the early days, you know, where it's not that sessy. It's like, you know. You can dip yeah. your toe in. Anyways, it's not as bad as it once was. It's not cool.
Right.
And that might be its saving grace. It's like, it's not cool, but it's getting slightly more right. enjoyable of an area to hang out. Anyways,
right.
you haven't put this on LinkedIn, but you work at a place called, what's it called?
It's called Istari Digital.
Istari. Okay.
Yeah. And
Yeah, it's a like a pretty
what are you
amazing.
Building? What is it?
Oh my
what
god!
Do they do?
What, like, do you have 3 hours? No, it's I will tell you.
Give
in
me
a
the
second.
One liner. What's the one liner? What's one on their website?
Liner? Oh my god, I'm not prepped for a one liner. Well, so what, speaking of websites, so we have this website that like I think was designed like when the company first started and nobody's touched it since, and mm-hmm. it is going through there's going to be a whole new, we're rebranding, and there's an official real for real okay. website
so
coming, so
don't go to the website, we
don't
won't
go to the website for another week or two.
Okay, fair enough.
We can link it in a week or two, I think.
Okay.
But no, it's basically a platform for, I mean, it's really for like, a, it's what I hate, you know, everyone says it's a platform for anything, but it really is. But the area that we're focused on is right now is digital engineering, which is this concept of, if I had to kind of explain it, like I, you know, like you're five, it's, you know, how folks working, you know, in aerospace and, you know, mechanical engineering, people building things for the physical world, you know, all the tools that they use, you know, how those things can connect. Like, so how do you actually connect secure, like highly secure, classified, you know, IP sensitive technical data? How do you connect all those threads together while, you know, being able to share, collaborate, have audit trails, and also, you know, protect your IP and protect the data, right? Mm. And so we have a zero knowledge, zero trust, multi-tenancy platform, you know, that has a control plane and a data plane that allows users to, you know, integrate all of their third-party tools and all the things that they use to do their regular jobs, and like pull data from those things and connect them. Like we have an IDE like experience where you can make a digital thread is what it's called. And actually one of the founders of the company was the person who actually coined the whole term digital engineering and digital threads. But it's, you know, how
so
do
what's
I take...
a digital thread?
Yeah. So digital thread is like, so I'll give you an example. So you take, you pull data from CAD, for example, or you pull data, let's even just like Excel, we go even more
sure,
basic.
Sure.
So we, you know, you can integrate Excel. We pull data from Excel. Then you can take those values, you know, using our digital IDE to then push them into another program. So you can pull values from Excel, push them into CAD, then take that CAD file, then push it to another program, run a simulation, right? And so you can actually build this kind of CI/CD, what we call CC, which is continuous compliance kind of like workflow, making sure that like while you're building this thing in the physical world, it's still complying to the metrics, right? So like how do engineers that are working on a physical thing, basically, how do they collaborate? So like how can they make sure that when they're making changes and they're tuning things, all this stuff is still like in bounds. It's all still works together. And also, how do we give people on the team situational awareness? How do we share just pieces of our data with our vendors? Like, so if, like, you know, I have a third party vendor who's building the tires for this airplane. How do I just share the specs that they need for, you know, right now, unfortunately, a lot of people, there's emailing of things, there's no secure way for people to share these, you know, these technical files and this technical data. Mm-hmm. And it also costs a lot of time, you know, when you don't have a way of digitally kind of certifying that something works. And so using our IDE, essentially using our SDK and our tooling and our integrations, you're able to kind of digitally certify things, you know, basically based on the source of truth, right? So you're able to connect all these authoritative sources of truth together and then say, okay, like this works, like this, you know, I'm actually running a real simulation. I'm actually looking at the real data. You know, I'm able to pull and extract different pieces and put it together. And so it's so essentially it's a digital engineering, digital threading platform, but the core architecture can be used for anything. Digital engineering. So aerospace and defense is the first industry that we're kind of focused on. And mm-hmm.
That's why you didn't need to raise any money.
Got a lot of money.
Get those customers going. Yeah.
You got it. Mm-hmm. And so, and what's really cool about this is like this, we are a trust platform, you know, like we don't look at your data. We use this, you know, tokenization workflow, which is, you know, we kind of bypass, we use our clients
to, you know, connect directly to, you know, storage buckets. And so, you know, we generate a token and we store a reference to that token in our DB, mm-hmm. but none of your data passes through our layer. Mm-hmm. And so hence the control plane data plane that we set up. And yeah, so it's cool. Just very, very cool. And in an age where everyone wants your data, you know, and everyone, like it's just really refreshing to be working on software that like mm-hmm. protects and, you know, like the whole
cares about that side of it. Yeah. Doesn't want the access.
We don't want the access.
Yeah. I can't lose what I don't have, or mm-hmm. I can't, you know, mistreat what I don't have or sell it later.
Yeah.
So meta question then, how did you find this place?
Oh yeah. Oh my God. So this is the best part about this drop. So like, this is why I'm like, you know, it's early, so I get to move at the pace that I want to. And what's really nice about startups, so anyone knows, like, you want to have an impact, you can have an impact. You just gotta, you know, the shovels are on the ground, just pick it up.
There you
know
go.
What I mean? Mm-hmm. But the way I got poached was actually through my colleagues at Exia at Stripe, the colleagues that I liked at Stripe. Mm-hmm. Okay. Me into this.
So they work there and they're like, let's get a mail.
Yeah. So yeah. Some of my ex-colleagues at Stripe work there, were settled, few people, both, you know, in high leadership positions in engineering, you know, both like VP of engineering or distinguished engineer, and then, you know, engineer, and then another engineering leader kind of reached out and was like, hey, you know, and some of these people are also people that I knew pre-Stripe, you know, folks I've had like long time friendships with, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, Maggie Johnson, Pint being the, I don't know, she's been on the pod before.
Yeah.
And all of this kind of was a funny timing for me, which maybe I'll get into the funny timing story later, but it's been this refreshing experience of working with really smart people on a very hard problem. And it's not just folks from Stripe, it's folks from, you know, many companies that you recognize, you know, a lot of the first, you know, companies that you know on a first name basis, but it's like everybody's favorite people from the jobs that they've worked at. So it feels like we've collected like all these awesome people and we are all working together. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a lot of people that, you know, worked on like really high level stuff in the Air Force. And as you know, like the military has been a source of a lot of big innovation, like, mm-hmm. except for I think Gen AI is the one thing that they've missed. And I think through our platform, hopefully we get to maybe help the government innovate on that, because there's a huge AI play for us as well. But, mm-hmm. You know, it's just been really nice working with innovators who have this background from the military as well, you know, working on just like really hard problems, like, you know, just for the Air Force, for Space Force, you name it, like people who have this expertise. You know, there's this nice kind of adult culture that we have at the company, which has been really refreshing for me, mm-hmm. You know, kind of. There's this like adolescent culture that kind of unfortunately is very pervasive in tech. And I think it's just been really refreshing to be at a company where, you know, actually you don't really need to bring your whole self to work. Like, you know, we're just kind of like actually here for a job. And, you know,
like, I like that.
Yeah. And then also just high diversity too. You know, you realize like the military is actually one of the most diverse employers in the world. And so, so there's just like, you know, I'm a woman of color and I've just had like, yeah, it's just been just very refreshing seeing the level of diversity within the company, but also just the fact that like no one really seems to care, like, you know, what your gender is or what your color is or whatever. Like we're all just getting things done, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's just been also really just refreshing on a personal level.
Yeah. So you're working on a digital threading platform. When I met you, you were all about the web platform.
Yeah.
You're kind of moving to a different platform now, right? Like, is the web just not part of your life as much? Is the web a deployment target? Is it play a role? And obviously, like, web tech certainly does, APIs, yeah. HTTP, et cetera. But is the web less important in your life these days, or?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, that's a deep question. I mean, so I am pretty much, like, exclusively working on software that, like, you know, working on, like, platform services and software that lives on, you know, that's installed on OSs,
yeah.
Things that like I'm
just deepen. Yeah, obviously we've got you know, we work on, you know, we have clients, we have SDKs and things
like that. No TypeScript then. You're just no TypeScript.
I'm not touching or dealing with TypeScript on a day-to-day basis at all.
You hear that, Nick Nacy? Neither of us are.
Wonderful internal UI for our app and all of that jazz, but that is not that is not my domain.
Are you actually coding? Are you speccing? What are you doing? Are you vibe coding?
All of the above. No vibe coding yet. Although, you know, oh my God, don't even, yeah. All of the above. Yeah. You know, writing software, doing a lot of architecture and design, not spending as much time as I want writing software. And that's always been a challenge when you're a lead, you know, cause you're in so many meetings, but, very involved with, you know, the actual design and rollout and of like what we're doing day to day. And then, yeah, you know, I basically lead an integrations platform. So we manage the interface and for how things connect into our platform, which is, mm-hmm. you know, and I've leveraged all my expertise, you know, everything, my NPM background. What I've created is essentially something very similar to MCP, actually.
Model Context Protocol?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Because we,
an acronym that I know, but I don't know much else beyond the acronym. I know the acronym and I know what they're trying to do, but I'm not sure. I don't know the protocol at all. So, and very few of us probably do. It's pretty new stuff. So feel free to elaborate if you want to.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, essentially I run a team that like one of the things that my team owns is agents. So we actually have agents that like do the tasks, do the work, you know, and we have an integration. We have an interface, a standard interface for how, you know, these third-party integrations connect in, you know, and that was kind of my first baby when I joined Astari. It was like, we need a clean way of doing this integration. Like this is a third-party integration. And so we kind of have something very similar to package managers, right? Like where we have different, you know, we have packages that can get installed and, you know, how those things get managed and published mm-hmm. and registered is all very, you know, borrowed a lot from my experience working at NPM. And what we've done is kind of created the standard way for any third-party package, any third-party tool to connect and integrate in with our agents, right? And so that our agents can like do the things, you know, that our users want to do on the other side, right? So we have functions that can be invoked, that users can invoke. And yeah, so I feel like I'm getting into the weeds and I'm like, I don't, you know, this is where I'd want to have like a screen and like pull up a demo.
Sure.
But
we don't have a demo available. So
we don't, yeah, we don't have a demo available right now. We don't have a screen, but like, I think it'll be worth it. Like once we're a little further along and we've actually just started to come out of stealth. We have, you know, we've been talking to a lot of customers, you know, we have, you know, many customers who, again, you would know on a first name basis, but we, in terms of like beyond our customers, like we're just starting to come out of stealth. And so mm-hmm. I think it'd be worth it to even just, once we're further along, I'd be happy to kind of come back on the show, maybe with Maggie, who's our head of product, to, you know, to kind of actually just talk through like, what is this? Mm-hmm. And we are hiring. Can I make a plug?
Sure. Go for it. I'm sure our listener would love to hear about someone hiring. That's always good right now. We want hires.
Yeah. If you're an infra engineer or, you know, hiring for also people from my team, please, yeah,
feel free. How do they? What do they do? They can't go to the website.
Find me on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn.
Are you going to be there?
I have a LinkedIn. I just DM me, and yes.
There you go.
I basically said that as soon as we update our website, I will update my LinkedIn.
Okay, so it's like a standoff. It's like playing chicken. You know,
it is. Yes, but no. DM me if you're Yeah, well, I'd love to talk about it more, but I basically, the long story short is I am in an exciting job that is super challenging and working on like really complex problems and also a lot of complex constraints. Like for example, like I'm not working on SaaS anymore, mm-hmm. right? And so this isn't just
no
a
web.
Pure SaaS. Yeah,
well, heck with the web. Done with the web.
No, we're not done with the web. I'm not done with the web. But this is not just a purely SaaS problem. We can host it and we do host it, but it's also you can run this fully on prem. And so, you know, having to design under a lot of constraints where something should be able to be fully on prem, something should be able to be fully functional in an air gapped environment, right? Like imagine basically our software.
How do you connect threads together in an air gapped environment? Doesn't even make sense.
Through the internet. Like,
well, it's air gapped.
Well,
there's no internet.
No, it's not intranet. I said intranet.
Oh, like, intranet.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. When I think air gapped, I think like you have to walk over to the computer to put something into it because there's no network at all.
Yeah, it's
not just an mean internal like network. Internal network. Gotcha.
Internal network. Nothing from the outside.
Right.
Yeah.
You have these different deployment targets on-prem, hosted.
Yep.
What
multi-cloud AWS, Azure, GCP, OCI,
will it run on my phone?
Not just AWS, AWS commercial and AWS, all the gov clouds, right? All the secure clouds too. Like it's which is its own thing. I've learned so much. I've learned not run on your phone yet. Maybe someday.
Well, that would be like the last deployment target. That or my dishwasher. I mean, what are you building over there? It's got to run on everything.
Everything. Again,
it's the everything platform that runs on everything.
Okay. It is. It really is. And so that's why this is like an exceptionally hard problem. And it's not just, my team, we own the agents. We own a lot of platform services. You know, we have stuff that we basically can, we're in the integrations. So we're like, we touch everything. We're in the middle of everything. And so it's also just, I think even just like hiring and for this team, you're looking for someone that is comfortable stretching themselves, not just, in terms of stack, but in terms of like, you're comfortable working on Windows targets on Red Hat, like Enterprise Linux, like,
sure.
You name it, like we
AIX, have to support right? Windows 95, you gotta run on everything. So you're in charge of agents. Like, how do you find agents working today? And I don't know, I have so many questions about agents. Like, what are they, where's their intelligence coming from? Like, what models are being deployed and are they good? I mean, I just feel like agents are still a promise, but not a reality.
Right. I feel like I've been working on agents before they were cool. I feel like, right. Cause it's been a year or so, but like a year plus for Starry. I've been there a year. And so basically think about it this way. They're like the robots of the future in the sense that like we need machines to be able to do remote execution for us and to be able to like remotely execute on tasks and remotely do work. Right.
Right.
And so in theory, like they should be really dumb, but like, then how do we make them smart? And so we make them smart through our integrations, through like, here's this, like, here's an integration. Here's code for you to go use this third-party module, right?
Right.
Like some third-party tool. And so
give that model some context. It's model give that context.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And then all the functions, but ultimately these are robots that are basically just following instructions. They're just kind of performing remote tasks. And so, I feel like we started this dance to some degree, with edge computing, right? Like, we need to be able to do compute on the edge. And
sure.
So now we need to be able to do more than just like compute. We need to be able to like have interactive compute on any edge, right? Like, and our agents are designed to like run on supercomputers. They're designed to run on your desktop. Designed to run on anything. What I mean? That's the other thing that, like,
can
I said,
that's
a very
hard
job. Can
you trust them to run on anything? Like, are they not going to execute the wrong thing out there?
Right. Right. The way we, and that's exactly why we have something called the control plane and the data plane, right?
Okay.
Like our agents don't, our control plane doesn't speak to agents. Agents speak to the control plane. And so, there's just a secure communication flow,
it's one way.
All the, right. And like, all the MTLS and like,
I don't know what that is.
Just encrypted, like,
okay, so TLS and, with an M on front of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I do know what it is. Thank you.
Right.
I'm with you. I'm back.
So there's just, there's a lot of, and then, PAT generation, right? Like, tokens, there's ways to make this secure. It is secure. Like, we, again, like security, like this is, Starry is essentially, our target is working with like the most classified, most sensitive information, right? So like this, secure is kind of core to security, and being secure is core to, core to everything, So I, like, again, like I said, why it's a hard problem, and I can't get into like everything.
Sure. Can you talk about models, or is that proprietary? Like
models,
like what models are these agents using for their intelligence? Are you using Llama? Is it DeepSeek? Do you have your own models that you've trained? Like,
I don't think I can get into that.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, like once we're further, I will. I'm excited to.
Would you use one of these to like buy yourself something off of Amazon? Like,
I would. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, hey, go get me a new sweater.
You can do anything you instruct it to do. Anything that a module, you know, anything that's in a, any function that's in a module is what it can do. So if you trust the module author, you can have it do whatever you want.
Right? So the agent is like a little program that runs other programs in a remote context.
Exactly.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Robot of the future.
Right? Have you thought and talked about agentic coding much? This is slightly upstream, but it's also in the world of agents.
Yeah. I've like read a little bit. Yeah. You know, and I've even seen some changelog stuff come up through on that. Like, right. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting is like there's so much innovation and change right now. Everything is like, you know, we're just kind of grasping and like it feels like a mound that's like continually shaping and reshaping. Like, I just saw something like, oh, is diffusion dead? Like, you know, like the thing that was so popular just like, what, two years ago or something, or like one and a half, you know? So it's just like everything is morphing. Everything is shaping. We are shaping and defining our future like day by day, hour by hour at this point. And so, I'm not like over invested in kind of keeping up with like all the specifics of the hype train, if that makes sense.
Right.
It's just for sanity. What I do know is that I am building for the future, and I've gone through my own journey with AI and usage of AI, and, you know, and basically like what I'm doing, and, you know, we're building a reference architecture to scale, you know, with LLMs. Yeah. That's kind of what we're doing at Astaria as well.
Mm-hmm. Take us on your journey.
Well, friends, I'm here with a good friend of mine, David Hsu, the founder and CEO of Retool. So, David, I know so many developers who use Retool to solve problems, but I'm curious. Help me to understand the specific user, the particular developer who is just loving Retool. Who's your ideal user?
Yeah, so for us, the ideal user of Retool is someone whose goal, first and foremost, is to either deliver value to the business or to be effective. Where we candidly have a little bit less success is with people that are extremely opinionated about their tools. If, for example, you're like, hey, I need to go use WebAssembly, and if I'm not using WebAssembly, I'm quitting my job, you're probably not the best Retool user, honestly. However, if you're like, hey, I see problems in the business and I want to have an impact and I want to solve those problems, Retool is right up your alley. And the reason for that is Retool allows you to have an impact so quickly. You could go from an idea, you go from a meeting like, hey, you know, this is an app that we need, to literally having the app built in 30 minutes, which is super, super impactful on the business. So I think that's the kind of partnership, or that's the kind of impact that we'd like to see with our customers.
You know, from my perspective, my thought is that, well, Retool is well known. Retool is somewhat even saturated. I know a lot of people who know Retool, but you've said this before. What makes you think that Retool is not that well known?
Retool today is really quite well known amongst a certain crowd. Like, I think if you had a poll like engineers in San Francisco or engineers in Silicon Valley even, I think it'd probably get like a 50, 60, 70% recognition of Retool. I think where you're less likely to have heard of Retool is if you're a random developer at a random company in a random location, like the Midwest, for example, or like a developer in Argentina, for example. You're probably less likely. And the reason is, I think we have a lot of really strong word of mouth from a lot of Silicon Valley companies like the Brexes, Coinbases, DoorDashes, Stripes, etc. of the world. There's a lot of Airbnb is another customer, NVIDIA is another customer. There's a lot of chatter about Retool in the Valley. But I think outside of the Valley, I think we're not as well known. And that's one goal of ours, to go change that.
Well, friends, now you know what Retool is. You know who they are. You're aware that Retool exists. And if you're trying to solve problems for your company, you're in a meeting, as David mentioned, and someone mentions something where a problem exists, and you can easily go and solve that problem in 30 minutes, an hour, or some margin of time that is basically a nominal amount of time, and you go and use Retool to solve that problem. That's amazing. Go to retool.com and get started for free, or book a demo. It is too easy to use Retool, and now you know, so go and try it. Once again, retool.com.
Take me on your journey.
Well, there's a lot of feelings. So my journey has just been like, you know, it was just like terrified first, right? Because it's like, what is this, right? It's like, oh, you know, and then you use it.
I don't like new things. This is scary. Yeah, sure.
And then you use it and you figure out, okay, actually, you know, this is really useful. And now I use AI multiple times a day, like every day, you know, and, you know, to do my work, to check my work, to like help clean up docs, you know, to write tests, whatever it is, right? Like, but there's just kind of this, you know, what I don't like that's going on is this hype from, you know, these, you know, founders, you know, Perplexity founders or whoever founders that are just like, in 12 months, like all code will be written by AI. And like, mm-hmm. you know, things like that are just, you know, they have to be taken with a grain of salt. These are people selling products, you know, they're not sure. gods. They cannot predict the future. And also like the role of the software engineer feels like it's very much shifting in the sense that like, I think we have to accept that AI is here. Right? Like mm-hmm. we have to get to a place of acceptance. And so, you know, how are we building and incorporating this into our products? How are we delivering more value for our customers using AI? Not just kind of the slap-on experience, but like how are we truly integrating this into our products in a way that makes sense, that solves problems faster for customers or internally or externally? Mm-hmm. And like, I think it's okay to be afraid. Like, I think that's normal and expected. Like I can say, it was FUD, you know, it was like fear, uncertainty, doubt, you know, it's probably, you know, mix of what I had, but I think, you know, being kind of more future focused, like, I actually think this is like a pretty exciting time if you're willing to just kind of like shut your fear, mute your fear for a second. And actually just kind of like see the opportunities ahead, like, which, you know, I think are actually pretty plentiful if you're willing to dig in and lean in. Unfortunately, this is yet another thing that's volatile and shifting for us. You know, it's like, man, like, can we ever get a break in tech? Like, you know, can I just get like 1 month of stability, you know, like just please, you know, but, you know, this is the job. This is the self-flatulating industry that we've all picked. And so here we are, you know,
we got a shiny new wheel that we reinvented. You better get that new wheel.
Right. But I don't know. What do you think?
So, I mean, I think, medium term, I'm not going to say the word bullish because I'm not necessarily, I think bullish implies that you're also excited about it. But like, I'm confident that our day-to-day work as now I'm talking about software engineering, not necessarily product development, but I think that our day-to-day work is changing and is going to continue to change over the next 18, 24 months. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where it plateaus. Or if it plateaus. I feel like I've hit a few plateaus over the last 24 months. Mm-hmm. But every time you plateau, then there's like a something, like you said, it's a month goes by and something else. And so I think where the agentic coding, where like where the AI is actually writing the code for you, is the next question mark for me. Where it's like, is this actually going to be the future? Because I think it's pretty clear that it's found its use in our lives mm-hmm. as an auto-completer. As a rubber duck programmer, yeah. right?
Right.
And we're okay with it, like spitting out boilerplate that we then agree to and change or whatever. But where the real gains can be had in productivity is like, can I have a fleet of little AI agents and I send them off to do things? Mm-hmm. And they're better than me at it anyways. And they do the things and they come back. And I'm done, or I'm moving on to my next thing, which some people think is like happening or will happen in the next 12 months. I'm just not, that's why I asked you, like, do you trust your agents? Because I'm just not so sure if and when that's going to be like human out of the loop, you know, because honestly, if I make fun of vibe coding all the time, mostly because I think it's a really fun term. Like, I'm really glad it got coined. I've made a bunch of memes about it. But if vibe coding could actually be the future of coding, like if they could get that good, it's going to be dramatically different. It's going to be very exciting. It's going to be very scary for people who make their lives, their careers coding.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure long-term if it's actually going to deliver on that promise. So that's why I ask people when agents come up, like, how good are these suckers? Because there are those who think, you know, I most recently read the Steve Yeagie post, The Revenge of the Junior Developer. I covered that in Changelog News. Of course, he works at Sourcegraph. And so I said that on the show. I'm like, he's selling tools that are going to put AI agents into your IDE. And so he's incentivized to be bullish on this. But he's saying, you know, fleets of agents are going to 10x, 100x in the next 12 months, our ability to write code at. And he's a smart person. He's not like just a hype boy.
Right.
I respect Steve. He's had quite a career. And I'm just not sure if he's right or not. So that's why I just don't know. I see a lot of stuff out there that's like, this is great for proofs of concepts and prototypes, but will it soon be great for production systems? Or is it always going to be, and by always, I mean over the next, you know, foreseeable years, just that quality of like, now we've got the prototype, now let's go build the thing. I'm not sure. That's why I ask everybody how they feel about agents. I feel like the agents you guys are deploying are different than coding agents.
Yeah. But they are different. But I think for us, you know, our goal is we want to have an LLM be able to write our integrations, right? Like that's the way we scale. Otherwise, it's like a boil the ocean problem, right? Because every company, every customer has their own stack and da-da-da-da-da, right? Like, and so that's kind of what we're working towards. I think in terms of the coding agents that you talk about, like, you know, just putting my, like taking my Starry hat off, right? And putting my like ML engineer hat on, like, you know, it's like, I'm not personally convinced that like we're ever going to have humans out of the loop if you want production software running, right? Like it's not this decade anyway, right? Like,
I'm kind of with you, but then I have to like check my bias and be like, is that because I'm a curmudgeon?
No, I don't think it is, because you need an AI to check the AI and then,
but
like,
can't you just do that? Like, they do have AIs, you know. One of the problems with hallucinations can be solved by simply having another one that checks the original one and being like, nah, that doesn't sound right. And so while we can't get to like 100% accuracy with this current technology, because they are just, you know, next word predictors, you can have AIs that watch AIs that watch AIs. And if you have enough of that, you can like, you know, on an infinite scale, approach zero. And so you can kind of solve that problem by literally having AIs watching AIs watching AIs.
Yeah, but at that point, it just becomes a matter of like compute and complexity, and you're managing a different set of problems. So you're just trading one bag of problems for another. And also, like, I'm sorry, like, is there a problem with using humans? Like, yeah, using AI to go faster seems like the best compromise, right? In the sense that, like, I think that's, you know, the kind of, you know, having the AI speed pack, I think, you know, the AI jet pack on a human, I think for me is what actually like the future looks like.
I think that's a surefire win. I agree with you that that's going to be and is even today, even at the most basic levels now, the way I use AI in my coding, which is basic.
Right.
I'm basic.
Yeah.
I basically, I'm not intended there. I have I don't do any of the fancy stuff.
Yeah.
All I do is, instead of ever getting a Google search, okay, anything that I would have previously just pasted into Google, I just paste it into LLM instead.
Yeah, same.
And that, even just that move, is probably like a 20% speed up boost over the Google path, because the Google path requires you to go read the result, click on this blog. Oh, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. Go back, go out. Mm-hmm. Here's a Stack Overflow thread. Oh, that's not exactly my problem. And so, like, of course, the LLM is going to be wrong 1 in 10, but
those odds are better.
Yeah, it's just better. Mm-hmm. So it's better than Google. And so me plus that is better than me plus Google. Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. Like I'm convinced of that. And so I think that as those things increase, those like automatic wins for human engineers to be better, like we just need to swipe those up and use them, you know, as engineers. But at a certain point, yeah, how good is it going to get is the question that I don't have the answer to.
Okay, so I hear that. Here's where I'm coming from, right? I'm sure people would, there's many people who would disagree with this, but I don't know, maybe not that many actually. But ultimately, like, your code has to be compliant, right? If you're running software for any business, like any business that's doing anything meaningful, you know, whether it's, you know, finance, education, etc., like there's some level of compliance that you have to adhere to. And so if you don't actually know what's in there, right? And you can't, like, you don't have a human in the loop guarantee, like you can't certify guarantee. Like for me, there's just a giant compliance problem that I see, you know, and then
there's also just lots of code that's sensitive, you know, like whether it's like financial algorithms and, you know, there's just a lot of kind of, you know, many, you know, critical software that like is dealing with like sensitive transactions, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. And then, you know, we've seen now with the recent vibe coding, right? Like how easy it is to hack these apps because they're so poorly made, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's just like, sure, people who don't have a software background can write apps by all means, like let's democratize that, go for it. But if you're trying to write something for in a production context that needs to be compliant and secure and then scalable and, you know, where you can actually fix a production problem, like within a timely manner, and basically any code that needs to run a real business that's like dealing with critical or sensitive and important stuff, like I don't see how this scales, right? And that maybe this is my like my 2025 basic mind, you know. She can't see the future. It's, you know, yada, 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 yada. But like, ultimately, like, I'm just trying to understand, like, where is all this poo-poo talk toward, like, why are we poo-pooing software engineers? Like, this is what I'm just don't understand. It's like, I feel like there's this attitude of like, oh, you know, we don't need developers anymore. Oh, we can be able to do this and that. And like, I just like, what have developers really done to kind of deserve this type of rhetoric? Like, do you know what I'm talking about, Jared? Like you've seen that, right?
Where it's just
like people are excited that like software engineering jobs are going to be reduced or diminished or software engineer roles or software engineers are going to have like less responsibility or whatever. Like there's just like this like celebration of like I don't even want to call it a downfall, but like a perceived downfall. Mm-hmm. And I just don't really understand where that's coming from, you know? And I think for me, like the only thing I can chalk it up to, like if keeping it totally real, is the fact that like, you know, software engineers are, you know, we have been able to assert some type of agency in this world, right? Like we're well paid.
Yeah.
You know, we're not in the like wealth class, but we're not like, you know, most people are like upper middle class, at least in North America.
For sure.
And so, you know, like we're like a group that has some agency, right? And we've also been able, like in terms of like being able to switch jobs or whatever else. I know recent years have been tough, but generally speaking for experienced engineers, like mm-hmm. I certainly still feel like I have agency, you know, I get hit up for stuff, you know? And so I'm just trying to understand like where, like why this hate towards developers, you mm-hmm. know? I don't know if you have thoughts.
I do. I mean, I feel like anything I could say would be generalizing because I think there's lots of different reasons right. why people might be excited about that. One of the memes that I made about vibe coding was, you know, the exit ramp meme where it's like mm-hmm. a car going on the highway and it could mm-hmm. be going straight, but then there's an exit ramp and then the car is like pulling a hard right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I made one of those because I had, you know, copious free time uh-huh. and like the straight path. And so in the car was the startup guy or the idea guy, I think I called him.
Yeah.
And like the straight path was like code school, you know, because that's really the ilk of the startup guy, the idea guy specifically, and gal, just a general neutral guy.
I get it. It's all
most of the time it's guys, honestly.
Yeah.
It just is that they don't have any ability to build what their idea is. Right. And so they're looking for a technical co-founder. Like that's a trope. That's a real thing.
Yeah.
And it's the plight of them because they can't actually do what they want to do because they can't do what they want to do.
Right.
Okay. So like the old way was like code school. And we'd be like, yo, just go to code school, work hard for, you know, however long it's going to take you. And then you can build your idea. And then the exit ramp now is this guy going vibe code school. You know, he's going to vibe code school.
Yeah.
Because now he can vibe code it. And that's very empowering to idea guys.
Right.
And I feel like, and this is just one particular stereotype. Okay. Right. Like I said, lots of different reasons, mm-hmm. but we have had agency. We've also had kind of superpowers mm-hmm. where it's like, we can take your idea and we can build it. Mm-hmm. And that's very valuable in the marketplace. But also right. if I have an idea, I just build that idea. Emil, if you have an idea, You just build it.
Just build it. Yeah. Yeah. When I have time. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We aren't actually very good and our ideas kind of suck. And there's lots of reasons why we still fail. But that's been a superpower for software engineers for ever since, you know, maybe the dawn of the internet. We could just take an idea without permission, build it, put it on the internet, you know, be the next Jeff Bezos or whatever it is.
Right.
Now other people think that maybe this is going to get them there. Right. And we're not necessary anymore.
Yeah.
So that's one possible reason why people are excited for the demise of the software engineer. It's like, well, we don't need you guys anymore. Maybe.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to that. Like, we've been a bottleneck, right? And mm-hmm. I think that's like, it's and a frustrating one, right? Because, there's so much of, unfortunately, one of the problems in our industry is, we have this. So in industry, unfortunately, in our industry, we fetishize a handful of companies, Everyone wants to work, for these handful of companies. And you have the, brilliant software minds, like highly underutilized at this handful of companies, such that really smart people are working on things like animating poop emojis, right? When they could be really solving critical problems for the government, they could, in education, colleges, all kinds of industries. Every industry needs to like level up its technology and digital transformation. There's just so much work to do, but we kind of, we're not line balanced, when it comes to where people are working and or where they want to work and or what they're working on, right? And so I hope that this period that we're in, in our industry kind of helps improve our line balance, right? Like, so that we're more balanced across like all the industries that need our support. But ultimately, like, we have been a bad bottleneck for all these people who can't hire good talent because either they're too expensive or there's too few of us, right?
Right.
So that's definitely one thing. And another thing is that, like, time is a real limiting factor, and AI lets us do more with our time. And, so that's fantastic. However, there's something called physics and like real world, like constraints, like, mm-hmm. time and like your body and all this other stuff. And so, there was a study that was done on like languages. And like, no matter like how fast you might think like Vietnamese sounds or Mandarin sounds or how slow you think English sounds, like the actual average like words per minute, like, spoken in any language, like, is actually roughly translates to be about the same.
Really?
And so which says something about like your brain's ability to process information, right? Like,
right.
We are still like singular human beings.
We're bandwidth constrained.
Bandwidth, right? So yes, we can do more and all the things, but ultimately, like, doing more also means managing more, right? So it's one of those things where, like, if my team is now shipping and shipping more and more features, each feature we ship needs some amount of maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, like, if the same amount of people keep making more work but not having, like, but we're not maintaining it, like, there's that math doesn't really add up, right? Like, and so. So yes, doing more means we need more, right? So that this is where I go back to, like, I don't see how any of this scales without people, right? Because yes, we can do more and produce more, but all of that code ultimately needs to live on infra. It needs to be maintained. It needs security patches. Yes, we're going to have AI be able to do a lot of it, but there's still going, with more AI generating stuff, there's still going to need, like, we're still, we might not need, as many people, but we still need people, right? Mm-hmm. And so by kind of us exponentiating via AI, I think there's still a growth curve for engineers, like a big one, actually, And so that's just, maybe I'm conservative, but I mean, that's kind of where I stand. And it's very frustrating to me to see this, like, this kind of all these AI startup founders, just kind of rejoicing at the, they're just brushing off the value that software engineers bring. Like, while all of these LLMs have been trained on work produced by software engineers, actually, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, give me and like, and, right? Not just trained on, but like, who produced this stuff? Who's rolling out this stuff, right? Like, I don't know. It's, we should be more angry about it. Let's just, I'll just put it there.
Well, they're disruptors, Amel. They're trying to disrupt the industry because there's lots of money to be made if you can make software without all of the people that you have to pay to make software. Right. Or if you can sell the tools that allow other people to do that. That's what a lot of these companies are trying to be, is the, the pickaxe salespeople during the gold rush. And the new gold rush is vibe coding. I mean,
that's exactly it.
That's exactly it.
You know, and so it's like, you know what? It's fine. Like, let people figure it out and fail. Like, this is why we have open markets and free markets, you know,
yeah.
Like ultimately, you know, there's room for experimentation and whatnot. It's just the challenge in our industry is that, like, we don't have the best leaders, you know, because there's something called FOMO and like domino effects of FOMO and mm-hmm. people just feeling like they're missing out and they act on imperfect information and they follow trends that are not really, you know, actually like well intended, well thought out, whatever, right? Like there's just things happen that I think, you know, yeah, people act on hype more than they should,
right.
Basically. That's to put it simply.
Let me take the other side of this for a moment, because you and I are pretty much in agreement, but we're also in similar places in our careers. And one of the reasons why Steve Yeagy called this post that he wrote, which it's a good read, you know, he's a good writer, so it's entertaining alongside him making his points. But he called it the revenge of the junior developer. And the reason why he said that is because he's noticed that junior devs or non-devs who are trying to get into it are way more open to accepting and trying and really trying to push the edge of these new technologies, specifically around, you know, agents coding and vibe coding and all these things. Whereas seniors and more experienced developers, you know, we're still testing the waters and stuff, or some of us are like, write it off and never going to use it. But we're just more stuck in our ways. And I guess I, in that sense, anti-democratization, because it's kind of like, and so from our perspective, our bias might be that way, because in a very real way, like, you've worked really hard to get where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so have I. I mean, maybe not really hard, but I put some work in. And you probably worked harder than I did. We don't need to compare.
We're, yeah, okay.
You know, we've been in the industry a long time.
We can both pat each other on the back.
That's right. That. That's yeah. right. But, you know, we're builders. So, like, correct. You can bring me your idea and I could build it. And that didn't grow on a tree, or that wasn't gifted to me by God when I was born, you know?
Right.
I worked hard to get there. And so, like, seeing people potentially be able to just acquire our skills without any effort, maybe that hurts a little bit. Maybe we don't like that. You know, there's a little bit of, I don't want to call it gatekeeping. Maybe it's guarding the castle, you know, because like this castle was hard to build and I'm valuable now as a worker because of the skills I've acquired. And I don't know, maybe I don't want that to go away. And so I prefer not to believe that it's going to.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that, because like, I feel like I see the same kind of phenomena happen in the South in the United States where they try, whenever they try to raise minimum wage past, like, you know, what it, I don't know, it's like something ridiculously low still in many, many parts of the country, like under $10, I think. Even whenever they try to raise it to like an actual living wage, there's just so much pushback. And I feel like that pushback happens because people are like, well, like, you know, it took me years to make that kind of money and I don't want, you know, like, you know, it doesn't make sense that like somebody would just get that right away. Like, mm-hmm. you know, this feeling that people need to earn it or go through the same level of
effort,
you know, that they did. And, you know, the reality is like, you know, sure, somebody using LLMs, by all means, like, I don't, like, I still see myself as being senior to that person, like, by a huge majority. I also think that having a software background with AI just puts me in a completely different, like, category, right? Like, it exponentiates me in the same way that it exponentiates that other person who has zero knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I have, like, you know, but these are like, it's exponentiation, so there's a high log factor, like, you know,
right.
to account for.
Right.
So we're still not on the same level, and I think software engineers need to understand that. Like, and that's why I said, like, earlier, like, acceptance is the first phase, and like the next phase is like you gotta get moving on this stuff and
right.
start building for the future. Keyword being future, right? Like, because if you dig your heels in and you're like, you know what, whatever, I'm going to like just show that I can do this from scratch and I can do it the hard way and this and that, like, awesome, you know. But I don't think the skills that, you know, that we used to pride ourselves on
are going to be as relevant anymore, specifically like the like free type coding for 20 minutes because you've memorized all the syntax. Like,
right.
You know, somebody's going to be able to code faster than you.
This is Unix. I know this.
Like, yeah, like, you know, like 10 times, like a bajillion times faster than you. So like, just, you got to like, we have to relearn some things, you know, in terms of the way we work. But I think this is all part of like the next phase of, you know, what it means to be a senior software engineer, in 2025, right? Like it's just, we have just new benchmarks, new ways of working. I think these are conversations we need to be having more. I mean, I think just, they haven't been happening enough. You know, it's just also just quite frankly, it's still a very challenging time, you know, but, you know, in terms of the market, the job market, you know, so.
For sure. No, I think that's a really good point. And to just to draw a gross analogy or a basic, just to get back to basics, you know, if we talk about a pickaxe, you know, imagine somebody who had spent years, you know, trying to dig gold with their hands, and then the pickaxe comes along. And it's like, hey guys, I've been digging gold with my hands, you know, I've been digging with my hands,
what,
and now
hell?
You get a pickaxe. So two points to that. The first one is you also get a pickaxe, okay?
Exactly.
So your life's better now.
Correct.
So just grab the pickaxe. And the other thing is, do you know how strong you got while you were like digging rocks up with your bare hands? And so when you put a pickaxe in your hand, you're going to be better at it, stronger. You know, it's a gross analogy. Then the person who just, you know, came off the streets and you hand them a pickaxe, you have skills. You can actually leverage the tool better than other people can. And so don't forgo the pickaxe because you got really good at using your hands. Like
you
grab that sucker and be good at it.
You got it. You know, and I think also just remember, y'all, like this is our industry. You know, for me, I have a lot of passion that I bring to my job and I have a lot of passion towards this industry because, you know, it helps me solve problems. It helps me, you know, build cool stuff, yada, 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 right? Like, I'm very intellectually satisfied. And like, you know, like this is like a huge source of like, you know, there's some value there for me. However, this is also just a job. And I think, you know, now more than ever, we really need to be focusing on like, not just boundaries, but just understanding that like, you know, there's more to life than tech, you know, because it's so ubiquitous. It's just important to remind yourself that like, you know, yeah, that, you know, just because AI is here doesn't mean that you need to spend like, you know, start another 8-hour shift when you're home. Like, you know, it's no, like you've got to find balance and just take care of yourself and your bodies. Because I think what's going to happen with this, you know, this Ferrari that everybody has now is like, you know, you can't be driving the Ferrari all the time. It's a lot, you know, it's a lot of cognitive overhead and overload that comes with this stuff. So yeah, I think we're still figuring out like how, you know, how we balance the, you know, the physics of our humanity with this, like with this kind of quote unquote, like infinite, like superpower, you know, like it's we're just, I think that's still TBD, but,
well, but to, I that think, point, yeah, to that point,
to that point. Yes. I think we're going to get to my favorite topic.
Do you want to talk about having a baby?
Yeah,
I mean, you had a baby.
I had a baby, everyone. I got an upgrade to mom.
Yeah. There's a title no one can take away from you, right?
Seriously. No. And that's it. Like becoming a mother has been a centering and clarifying experience, and actually, you know, it's a surprising side effect happened as well, which is actually me being more confident and efficient at work even, right? Right. Like I felt like I was already pretty confident, probably could have been more efficient, but generally pretty efficient.
Yeah.
And I think it just comes down to that age old saying of like, you know, if you want something done, give it to a busy person, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that's like, a classic.
Yeah. Because
you're busier than you've ever been.
Busier
Which
than
means
I,
you got to get stuff done because you don't have time to screw around.
I don't have time to bike shed all the things. We just got to get it moving.
Yeah, you know, there is a clarity that comes from like what's actually important here.
Oh yeah.
When you just don't have time to dork around, you know, you're like, no, I'm not gonna spend a half hour on what color this bike shed should be.
Exactly. That's exactly. And so it's just been this thing that has brought, I feel like it's been like a fluff compressor, like a pillow, like you take a pillow that has all the air. And then if you like scrunch it down, like, it's like, oh, this pillow is actually like a lot smaller without the air. Like, I feel like mm-hmm. I had all the air being fluff in my life or something along. And I was already like, you know, it had a lot going on, but like now it's just, I really am pressed for time. And so, you know, it's just in real like do mode. And I think also, you know, a problem that I've had historically in my life was, you know, being a perfectionist and, you know, wanting everything to be perfect. And I think that's also just, I've had really good practice with just like, oh, no, actually, no, this doesn't have to be perfect. Like, it's brought me to this like new phase of my life as well, which has been very healthy. And again, mm-hmm. productive, right? Because you know you're not letting perfect get in the way of good, you know,
right?
And so
you don't have a choice anymore.
Exactly. And so
but you don't get to sleep very much, do you? I mean,
actually,
how old's your child?
So my son is he's turning 6 months.
Okay, so you're outside of the real hard area. Is he a good sleeper though?
He is, thank goodness.
That
yeah
helps.
we're in, like, he's been sleeping like, you know, 8 hours.
Oh yeah, that,
like,
helps.
Since like he was 3 months, and so thank God, because it was, I, you know, I took like 3.5 months off of work, and it was just, he, you know, just in time for returning to work.
Yeah.
But no, I you know, it's just one of the reasons why I, you know, life just got very busy. I was just at this, you know, Astari has been like, whoa. I mean, I've never worked at the pace that I have while not feeling an ounce of burnout. And then that's just amazing. And I realized, like, oh, you know, why is it that I felt burnt out at other jobs? And it's like, oh, it's because like burnout isn't necessarily about working hard. It's like, it's actually when you don't feel like you're making as much traction as you should be, and you're working really hard and things aren't moving, you mm-hmm. know, you get burnt out sometimes, or when you don't get the gratification back, you know. But it's just been this really nice, like, work hard, get done, ship, make a difference kind of, like, and, you know, working in a high, high trust environment, with really smart, kind people in a rapid fashion, has just been really, for me at this stage in my career, like, I feel like I'm bringing it all together. Like, I'm bringing in all of my skills, you know, alignment, design, you know, working on, you know, complex problems, like all the experience that I have just in software engineering from all the jobs are coming into this role, and I get to kind of exercise all these skills, leadership, you name it. And it's just been really fun. I didn't know I was going to enjoy early startup this much. I hope to be able to kind of just stay with Astari and, like I said, just kind of retire. That's my goal. I don't want to work anywhere else.
I was gonna say, I think stability at this point is probably attracted to you, because you've had a lot of jobs over a not very long time. I mean, right, you've moved a lot.
Yeah, right. And moving is also like, that moving is just come from like impatience on my part. Like, I, like, in the, you know, mm-hmm. minus the NPM layoff, really everything else is just like me being impatient and being like, oh, I'm done. Like, F this, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, and so that's nice. That part is nice. And then what else? Yeah, it's just amazing. Like, being
so
a mom.
So you work from home then? I mean, a lot of the challenges are around logistics, of course, the timing, like the baby's crying while you're in a meeting, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Hard.
It's honestly been, you know, knock on wood, you know, thank God. It's
hasn't been a problem.
Extremely smooth. I have like, we have a 5-bedroom house. I have childcare right in my house. You know, I get to like, I'm nursing parent. I feed I feed my son on like a, just get off camera. I'm telling people what to do, and I'm feeding my kiddo.
It's awesome.
That's been awesome. Somebody's gonna, you know, make sure my husband gets a photo of that at some point for our own internal memory book. But yeah, it's been, you know, just, you know, so it's work. It's, you know, it's work. We're both busy. You know, and my mom's also coming to help. She's retiring. So then, you know, we're going to have even hopefully more help.
Cool.
But it's been seamless so far, and just also just very rewarding. I actually already want to do,
I was going to ask if you're going to scale, like, are you thinking scale?
I want to do this again, which is like crazy, because from like day zero to day 59, I was just like, this is amazing. I'm so glad we did this, but holy moly, like, how do people do this more than once?
Never doing it
and
again.
Then day 60 hit, and then it was just this shift instantly. I was like, oh, we're in a groove. We got this. Let's do this again. Like, can you believe it? Like, it was just this like overnight switch. But no, I definitely want to do it again. I'm reserving the right to change my mind, But I think, you know, like in a year or two, I'd love to give this another whirl.
Are you an only child?
I am not an only child. I have two siblings, but we are so far apart in age. Like it, like I'm like so 6.5 years. Yeah. So I want to do something like not like that for my
son. Yeah. You know, I think only child is tough. I mean, we have a large family, as you know, and my wife came from a large family. I'm one of three, and older sister, 3 years older. And my brother was 8 years younger than me, 11 years younger than my sister. And so he was, I mean, he's not an only child, but kind of like you, where it's like, he was kind of raised. We were already, I mean, I was in middle school when he was in a toddler. And so he's kind of raised like an only child.
Yeah.
And I've just seen like, even our kids, like we have built-in friendships, like inside of your own family, like there's just a safety and a blessing to that, that I think is irreplaceable. So
yeah,
I would definitely encourage you to scale, you know, have a few agents running around.
Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, Jared, if I knew I was going to love being a mom this much, I would have done it like way sooner. Like I held off so long. And you know, the funny thing with the timing, by the way, I didn't get back to that. So I was like interviewing for like, I was this crazy person that was like, I want to go back to the office because I really miss being with my colleagues. And I was like, you know what? I want to start a job where I'm in the office once a week or so. So I was like interviewing for jobs out of New York City. I was going to commute into the city. We were going to get a little studio there. Yeah, because my husband and I, we moved, we left Boston. We went to the other side of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. We like bought a house in the Berkshires. And so we're like 2 hours from Boston, 2 hours from New York now. And we spend a lot of time in both cities like still. And so I was like, oh, we can just get like a studio in New York and I can be there like, you know, a few times a month. And I was interviewing with, you know, I was like, actually my first choice was Datadog. Like they had actually like, if you're listening to this, the person from Data, he listens to Changelog, they like were so generous and like made this, you know, incredible offer to lead this team that was very exciting to, you know, to me. And I just had to kind of walk away from that whole thing because I found out just as I was about to start my interviews that I was pregnant. I didn't think it was going to happen that quick. I was like, wait, what? No, I'm in my like late 30s. Like there's no way, like I think it was 37 at the time. And I was like, there's no way that I'm going to get pregnant this fast. Everybody I know has trouble getting pregnant. And I was like, I have like 6 to 12 months. I'm like, no problem. And it happened right away for us because I don't know how science works apparently. And you know, I falsely applied statistics to myself that like, you know,
generalized, but you're not a generalization. You're a specific.
Yeah. So I thought, you know, there's no way I'm getting pregnant right now. And then I got pregnant and I was like, okay, well, this changes everything. And so I just kind of paused on all my like New York City jobs. I was like, I'm not going into an office.
Yep.
And then, you know, fortunately this starry thing came along, Maggie found out that I was like open. And that I was like regrouping, like, you know, that I was like, oh, I'm like figuring out what I like I now need to just like focus on remote roles. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, hey, if you're open, we're actually like hiring, like we need you. Like, so, and that was it. That's how I got started. Gotcha. So it's good to have friends, people, keep in touch with your network.
For and, sure.
Let them, you know, you never know where your next opportunity is going to come from. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, exciting times. Happy to catch up with you. And now I know the full story. I'm very excited for you for your scale. Maybe you'll catch up with my wife and I one of these days. I don't know.
I don't know if you have enough
time left. 37.
Honest, I'm not 37 anymore, actually. But okay. but I am north of that. I'm telling you, like if I can squeeze in two kids, I would love to. But realistically, like I think just like one more. Realistically. But
hey, you're not a statistic, so you know, go for the gusto and just see what happens. Nobody knows their own body. I'm just curious, why did you decide to wait so long?
It was fear. Really, it was like I wasn't sure how I was going to change. You know, I like my life. Like I like who I am. I've worked really hard on myself, you know, professionally, personally, all the things. And I was like really afraid of becoming one of those parents that just doesn't have a life and like doesn't do anything other than child stuff. I see a lot of parents like that. And I was like, I just didn't know. Like it was such a black box. And so I think there was a lot of fear. Like I've been in a stable relationship for a long time. Like my husband and I have been together for a long time. And so, you know,
it wasn't like anything relationship wise that was holding me back. It was really just fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
And then it was just kind of like, oh, we're just going to do this. And like, I didn't even think about it. Like, if any of Changelog listeners see me in person, I will tell you the story of how I found out. It's a little too personal to share in like a 10,000 person podcast, but it's a pretty funny story. It took me not thinking about it to do it because, like, you know, if I continued to think about it, I would have just never done it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You just had to kind of just whatever, go for it.
Rip off the Band-Aid.
But it was really fear that was holding me back. And now I know that I'm still me and I'm still, not only am I still me, but I'm still motivated, like in a way that like I feel is coming from a place that's even more stable. And, you know, there's no vanity, right? It's like, I want to do well so that I can take care of my family. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I now have somebody depending on me, you know? And so it just changes the stakes. Like it's no longer, you know, just like doing well for the sake of doing well. Like there's something more meaningful behind it. Not to say that people who don't have children don't have, like, that's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
It's just that, like, you know, my motivations are now driven, you know, I think from a more, less vain external like dependency.
You got a dependency.
You got a
supply chain you got to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's just like all the things that I didn't even think I would enjoy, I'm enjoying. Like, I didn't even think about, like, okay, dressing my baby is so much fun. And then, like, watching my baby's development is so much fun. Mm-hmm. And then, like, teaching my baby and, like, reading to my baby and singing to my baby. And, like, all these things, it's like, wow, you didn't even think about it. You know, like, I didn't, you know.
Right.
But I'm really enjoying this. I hope, you know, we're blessed with, you know, being able to do this again. And I think it's just a good antidote, you know, for me personally. With everything that's happening in the world and all the uncertainty, my little nuclear bubble, you know, is a huge source of gratification and love and, you know, clarity and all the things. And it just, you know, it just puts a lot into perspective.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said. Let's end on that.
Yeah.
Love catching up with you. We'll have to do it again sometime.
Definitely.
And once Astara gets that website out, we're gonna check it out.
Yeah, we have a website. It's just not great.
No, I don't know.
The
new one.
Yeah,
The better one.
The better one.
So congrats on everything. And
thank you.
We'll talk soon.
All right. Cheers. All right.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. That's the change log for this week. Thanks for friending with us. Do you share all the feelings Amel shared on the show? Let us know in Zulip. We would love to hear from you. So sign up, why don't you? If you haven't already, at changelog.com/community. It's totally free and it's totally awesome, in my opinion. Thanks again to our awesome sponsors, Fly.io, Heroku.com, Depot.dev, and Retool.com. Please support them. They support us and they have awesome offerings. And thank you to our bee freaking residents. Breakmaster Cylinder keeps us topped up with fresh beats, and we love that. Hopefully you do too. Have a great weekend. Share the change log with your friends if you dig it. And let's talk again real soon.